Hello and welcome to the March 2026 edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynmouth area talking newspaper's monthly magazine. I'm Camilla Taylor. Let us find out what we have in store for you this month. John Townsend will be in conversation with David Force. This will be followed by a piece of music of his choice. Fran Frank has put together another set of 10 quiz questions for you. The answers will appear towards the end of the programme. David Picton will share his poem entitled In Everybody's Life. Norma Orty will be reading her story entitled Bargain B&B. Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor will be discussing the book The Help by Catherine Stockett. Roland Burroughs will be sharing another extract from his memoir. This one is from the chapter Guns, and is about his two encounters with guns being used in a menacing manner. Once was when he was on a school trip to France, and the other was in Cornwall when he was filming a TV commercial. In her segment, One Foot in the Past, Viv Wilson will be sharing the story of Maurice Mortimer of Tynmouth. Fran Frank will be back with the answers to the quiz questions. In his segment entitled My Great Passion in Life, David Quay will be sharing his love of the music and lyrics of Gilbert and Sullivan. We will conclude the programme with a piece of music from Gilbert and Sullivan's HMS Pinafore.
Hello, it's John Townsend again with another Performing Arts Devon Dialogues, where I get to chat with musicians, actors, singers, dancers, theatrical directors, and more besides, who work and perform both locally and further afield. Now, my guest today is well known in and around Dawlish as a writer, raconteur, historian, and performer with many tales to tell about bygone Devon and Dawlish in particular. So a big welcome to our studio, David Force, and thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon to you.
Well, I suppose we should really have called this chat a tour de force, or a force to be reckoned with. Yet you called one of your first books simply Dawlish Through the Ages, a collection of 15 short stories, and then a couple of sequels entitled Eavesdropper 1 and Eavesdropper 2, which include light-hearted illustrated adventures ranging from Saxons, Vikings, Tudors, Georgians, Victorians, and I think where you actually meet Brunel himself, indeed, as well as the Home Guard, smugglers, and even an Iron Age tribe, all getting up to goodness knows what right here in Dawlish. So before you tell us about just some of your creative work over the years, David, can I ask my usual question? How did it all start? I'm intrigued to know how and why you became interested and involved in local history in the first place. And how did your performance shows kick off? Just when and where did you become addicted to storytelling? Take us back a little, if you would, to, well, your own history.
Right. Thank you very much indeed, John. Good afternoon. Lovely to be here. My career was as an estate agent. My family existed in the Exeter area going back hundreds of years. So the family firm was in Exeter. I worked away for a couple of years, came back to Exeter in 1979 to join the family firm, also to continue auctioneering, which I'd been doing for a few years. And that happened so that I was part of the firm when my granddad wanted to retire or ease off a bit, because Forces never really retired in that day and age. So I came back, started working. My brother came back a couple of years later. The firm at that time really wasn't quite big enough to support myself, my brother, my granddad, who was still working here and there, and my dad as well. So there's four forces to be reckoned with. Mm-hmm. So it was decided that we'd open another office. And whereas most agents at that time, we're talking about 1981, were expanding to Exmouth, I said, well, look, why don't we try Dawlish? It's the other side of the estuary. No other Exeter agent has gone there. Let's go and have a look at it, see what it's like. So I came down to Dawlish with my dad, and we looked at around the town, found some premises, and I said to my brother, look, I'll do the first 6 months in Dawlish. and to get it going, then you can come down, do 6 months, and we'll keep swapping.
So I was going to say, did you fall in love with Dawlish when you first
I definitely did. As a child, when we lived in Exeter, we used to go to Holcombe Beach quite a bit. That's where I learned to swim and build nice big sandcastles. But we didn't actually come to Dawlish. Dawlish Warren we did, because we, funnily enough, November the 5th, we used to come down to the dunes in Dawlish Warren and we used to collect driftwood that had come ashore, have a bonfire and set off fireworks.
Yeah.
But Dawlish itself was a bit of a mystery to me. But we thought, well, we'll give Dawlish a go, open the premises. I said to my brother after a few weeks, I don't think I'm going to be able to leave here because it's a very small town. Everybody knows everybody else. If I do 6 months, the people just get to know me. Then you'll come down, you won't know anybody, and then it could peter out.
So it worked out beautifully, and your business flourished.
Yes, and I have 40 years working in Dawlish, and then retired just before COVID.
Yeah,
sold the business on to Darton Partners. But my love of Dawlish started very quickly, and because I used to go into so many houses, offices, shops, and so forth, I got to know about the architecture and a bit of the history of the town, and that sort of ignited a flame, because I'd loved writing stories at school.
Yeah,
I thought, well, I could make a book out of this. And my mum was trying to persuade me to write a book as well. And also, I got to know a chap called Jim Holman, who was editor of the Dawlish Gazette and had recently retired. And he was called Gentleman Jim. What he didn't know about Dawlish wasn't worth knowing. And he lost his sight quite late in life, but he knew Dawlish so well that he never needed a guide dog, but he would go out walking round the lanes behind Dawlish, totally on his own with just his white stick. And if you spoke to him and knew exactly who you were, he knew everybody's voices. Absolute wonderful man.
Yeah.
And he really got me into the Dawlish history.
Do you remember your very first story?
I used to go round to dinner with Mum quite a bit, and I would tell her, oh, did you know the Dawlish? I just found this out about Dawlish. And I kept doing this, and she said, why don't you write a book about it?
Yeah.
So I wrote a book, was about 30 pages long, which was just for her. And then my auntie Christine, who lived in Exeter, said, oh, you know quite a bit about Dawlish now. I belong to the local Conservative Association, which I knew, and we're looking for speakers. Why don't you come along and give a talk about Dawlish? Which is what I did. And I can't remember the date of that, but I think it was the early 90s. That was how it started.
And obviously went down well, and they said, can you come back, or can you do some
They
more?
Asked me, but nobody walked out, nobody booed. So
you obviously have a delivery. I guess you make it come alive.
The thing is, I don't like to talk down to people. I like to feel that my talks are chats.
Yeah,
Then I should try and get a sort of bit of interaction going.
Would you say it's a performance? Do you do characters or voices?
I don't actually mimic somebody, but some of the talks I do dress up as Brunel.
Okay.
With the stovepipe hat and the cigar and a long frock coat and things.
Oh, brilliant.
And other talks I dress up as an Edwardian dandy with a bow tie and things. So, yes, it is a performance.
So it is,
And I think I'm used to public speaking because I've been an auctioneer all my life as well.
Yeah.
I've done 50 years as an auctioneer. I was about 3 when I started, so I'm not that old.
Yeah. So you're not troubled by an audience, is what you're saying? Yeah.
Not once I start.
No.
I think I'm a bit like an actor in as much that before I go on stage, I've got butterflies, a bit of a dry throat.
Yeah.
Beating heart, thinking, how's this going to go?
Yeah.
But then once I'm on stage and start,
you're away. Yes.
People find it difficult to stop me.
Yeah. Well, I think it's healthy to have a bit of nerves to start with. It keeps you,
It is. Any actor would say the same, really.
Yeah.
That, yes, if you're too blasé or too relaxed,
that's
you're not going to give your best.
Yeah. Good. And so I know you have done talks, performances at the Shaftesbury Theatre here in Dawlish. And I think you've got one coming up. Well, you're hatching another one.
We're hatching another one for the autumn,
And they, I think, go down very well. I think they're sold out.
Sold out each one. We've raised a lot of money because I do it with a chap called Jimmy Hill, who's a local boy, made good. He used to run Swift Print in Exeter, in Dawlish. Yeah, he does the first half with his childhood growing up in Dornish. I do the second half, starting with whoever I start with, Bronze Age people, or the oldest people we know of who settled in Dornish, and then going right through. And what you said about the characters I've had in my books is that, yes, all those people have existed and walked the streets of Dornish. Mm. And that's what I really like about it, is that when I'm walking around Dornish, I imagine myself in different eras. Mm-hmm. Take the traffic away, take the telegraph poles away and everything else, and just imagine how Dornish used to be.
Yeah. Do you have a collection of photographs, archive material that you've collected, I guess?
I've got loads and loads of actual facts. Yeah. And yes, some of them quite well known. Some of them I find on eBay and places, and they're not seen by anybody. And I use those in my talks to illustrate what I'm talking about. Yeah. Not only photographs, but old prints of Dornish as well. And there are a lot of old prints. Dornish used to be a very elegant resort. What I used to say was that in days gone by, it was a sort of a champagne resort. These days, it's more a pint of lager and a bag of crisps, really. Yes. We have gone, I hesitate to say, down market. That's the sort of people we attract now, aren't the elegant folk that used to be here in Edwardian times.
Well, I think it's up to you and me to reverse that, don't you?
We'll
do what we can. I'm very interested in Dawlish and seaside towns of sort of the 1950s. I'm doing a play next year, hopefully, based on that. But how it's changed, how entertainment, seaside entertainment, has changed so much since, of course, television and transport to, you know, package holidays. So you probably have lots of material of Dawlish when it was in its heyday, sort of post-war. Yeah. And
it is fascinating because, as you say, the entertainment has changed so much. And I remember, I think on Dawlish Warren Beach, there used to be Punch and Judy there, which for threepence, for three old pence, you could sit and watch Punch and Judy on the beach. There were donkeys that you could ride round as well. Yes, entertainment was cheap.
Yes,
you know, it was free, really. And in Dawlish Warren in particular, playing in the dunes and swimming in the sea was
ideal. You were telling me earlier about the number of hotels that Dawlish had alone.
We had several very posh hotels. We had the Grand, the Royal, the Commercial, the Temperance Hotel. The first two hotels in Dawlish were actually here by 1785.
Right.
So that was when Dawlish first became a resort, thanks to George III and his love of the coast. And I could go on for hours about how people used to come to Dawlish to escape the pollution of the Midlands and the North. Yeah. The wealthy entrepreneurs and industrialists and mine owners and things would come to Dawlish for the mild climate, the ozone, swimming in the sea, drinking seawater.
Yes.
Which used to be.
Which I wouldn't recommend now.
Nowadays, no. Southwest Water are trying to clean the water up, but I wouldn't trust it too much.
Some work, yeah. No, David, obviously you've got so much to talk to us about. I'm going to ask you if you'd perhaps come back sometime so we can look at some of these stories in a bit more detail.
I'd be delighted.
And maybe get you to read an extract from one or two of your books.
Indeed.
And we'll tell listeners where they can get them, but it'd be nice to have you reading some of them. But for now, thank you so much for talking to us. And I'm going to ask you, as we do with all of our guests, to choose a piece of music to finish with today. I wonder what you'd like to choose.
Thank you very much. Well, from a teenager, I used to be, or I still am, very interested and keen on prog rock or progressive rock music. Okay. And one of the earliest bands I heard was Emerson, Lake and Palmer. I've chosen Lucky Man by Emerson, Lake and Palmer, which is very melodic. And also, I feel that I've been a lucky man to spend my career in Dornish.
Well, that's a good reason. Are they an American band or British?
They're a British band.
All right. Okay.
Sadly, only one of them is still alive. Keith Emerson was perhaps the best keyboard player, apart from Rick Wakeman, of all time. Greg Lake was an amazing bassist and had the most beautiful voice, which comes on Lucky Man. And then the ones that's left is the drummer, Carl Palmer, who was voted best drummer in the world for several years as well. So they're what's called a super group.
I can tell
1970s.
You're a fan. So you'll have to sing along with it.
No, I don't want to spoil Greg Lake's voice.
Well, look, it just remains for me for now to thank you, David, for telling us about just some of your involvement in local history and performing, and best wishes for your next projects and beyond. Thanks so much for chatting. But
goodbye for now as we go over to Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
Thank you very much.
White horses and ladies by the score, all dressed in satin and waiting by the door. Ooh, what a lucky man he was. Ooh, what a lucky man. Lace and feathers, they made up his bed, a gold-covered mattress on which he was led.
Ooh, what a lucky man he was.
You have just listened to the song Lucky Man from 1970 by the group Emerson, Lake and Palmer. It's now over to Fran Frank for the quiz questions.
Hello, Hello and welcome to Quiz Corner. As usual, I have selected 10 questions on a variety of subjects and will provide you with 3 possible answers. So let's begin with question 1. Which man-made Egyptian waterway connects the Mediterranean Sea to the Red Sea? Is it A, the Panama Canal, B, the Suez Canal, or C, the Canal du Midi? Question 2. Baobab, monkey puzzle, and banyan are all types of what? Are they A, magic tricks, B, tree, or C, fruit? Question 3. What did Tom steal in the first line of the nursery rhyme, Tom, Tom, the Piper's Son? Was it A, a pig, B, a rabbit, or C, a shoe? Question 4. Where is the harbour wall known as the Cob, which featured in the novels Persuasion and the French Lieutenant's Woman? Is it A, Broadstairs, B, Bognor Regis, or C, Lyme Regis? Question 5. Which ITV series starred Felicity Kendall and Pam Ferris as a pair of gardening detectives? Was it A, Rosemary and Thyme, B, Sage and Onion, or C, Parsley and Sage? Question 6. In a famous book by Anna Sewell, what kind of creature is Black Beauty? Is it A, a cat, B, a dog, or C, a horse? Question 7. Red, fallow, and roe are all varieties of which British mammal? Is it A, deer, B, fox, or C, squirrel? Question 8. In which year was the London Eye constructed? Was it A, 2000, B, 1995, or C, 2010? Question 9. Santiago is the capital of which South American country? Is it A, Chile, B, Ecuador, or C, Brazil? Question 10. What is the surname of TV wine taster Gilly, known for her creative descriptions of wine? Is it A, garden, B, golden, or C, Goulden? Well, there you are, 10 different questions on a variety of topics. I'll let you listen to the rest of the program and come back later to give you the correct answers.
David Picton is here with his poem for this month.
This is a poem that presents a few observations and statements about our lives. It's called In Everybody's Life.
In everybody's life, a little seed must grow. It's nature's way we learn to know. In everybody's life, a little sun must rise, to wake each day with new surprise. In everybody's life, a little rain must fall, to know we've been alive at all. In everybody's life, a little flower must bloom, that we may bathe in life's perfume. In everybody's life, a little child must leave snotty tears trailed on dirty sleeve. In everybody's life, a little knife must twist, that pain and joy can coexist. In everybody's life, a little fear must stalk, so take care it with each step we walk. In everybody's life, a little love must cost, so when it's gone, we know what's lost. In everybody's life, a little blood must shed, to be prepared for what we dread. In everybody's life, a little us must give, that when we die, our memories live.
Beautiful. We now have a story from Norma Orty.
Bargain B&B. Retirement at last. Leisure lies before you as a reward for a lifetime of work. The nest is empty. The children have flown, following their future and leaving you free. Now that you have time, you can read the magazine articles and the travel ads. The world is yours to explore. Europe, Asia, America, cruises, sun-drenched beaches, and far-flung cities. You hope that you can afford to experience it all. Being a modern, youthful retiree, you have been surfing the web to discover the cost of your dream for two. By searching, you have found the best deal in air travel, cattle class, of course. You can get to your destination, but where to stay? A decent double room with breakfast costs the earth anywhere. This was our problem when a few years ago we had the opportunity to visit the States and Canada. As it was partly business, our fare was paid, but accommodation for 8 weeks was to our own account. By chance, we read about home exchange and hospitality exchange, and were then introduced to the Evergreen Club and Affordable Travel Club. The latter clubs were designed for the over 50s, for those keen to travel, who are also prepared to host strangers. Members received a directory, either online or by mail, and are free to make their own arrangements. Email is a great advantage. The nominal fee to the host is either $15 for Evergreen or $20 for ATC, that is for a couple for bed and breakfast. One travels with the knowledge that a pleasant room awaits in the home of friendly, helpful and like-minded people. Other arrangements are frequently made between couples, such as dining in or out and sightseeing. Most stays are from 1 to 3 nights, but some hosts are happy for longer stays. Members are found in many countries, but don't overlook the convenience of staying with one next time you go to Johannesburg or Cape Town. We have made many friends throughout the world and already thinking ahead to our next trip. The writer will be pleased to answer any questions.
That was an account of Norma and her husband's holiday from several years ago. Now Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor are here with this month's book review.
Hello, listener. This month, Stephen and I have been reading The Help by Catherine Stockett. It's just lovely. For some listeners, this will be ancient history, and for some, it's just something that's gone on through our lives. Some of us of a certain age, this was part of our childhood in all countries, but it's horrendous, particularly horrendous in America. It's about a white lady of some quality and all the various coloured helps in the homes of herself and her friends. These ladies raised all the white children, often more close to those children than their own parents were. It's very touching, very hard in some places to read. Really enjoyable. I have friends who've seen the film. Oh, you must read the book. So here I am. I'm reading the book.
Yes, well, I agree. It's wonderful. So we're in Mississippi. It's the 1960s, early 1960s. I think the book starts in 1962. It goes through to about 1964. So it's when the civil rights movement is getting going and change is in the air. And the setting is a very old rural kind of community where you have racial segregation. It's not that different from the apartheid South Africa situation. So you have these things called the Jim Crow laws that were still in place at that time, which mandated separate schools, separate libraries, separate cinemas, separate toilets for people who are black and people who are white. And they live separate lives. There's obviously a huge difference in terms of their economic power, in terms of their equal opportunity, all of those things. But there was contact, and the one main way in which there was a lot of contact was that the wealthy white people employed black ladies as helps, hence the title The Help, many of whom were involved in domestic activity, but also bringing up children. And the book is all about them. There's hardly any men in this. It's almost an entirely female cast. The men are very incidental, all thoroughly unpleasant, but some of the women are quite unpleasant too. But at the heart of it, fantastic narrators, and it's completely compelling. It takes a little bit of getting into it.
I think so.
Obviously,
yes.
The language is a little bit.
I did find myself thinking that as I was reading it, and then I went to do something else, and my actual mouth was trying to be like that. But are you saying about the men? There were one or two quite nice men, really. One or two totally obnoxious. But this seemed to be part of the makeup at the time. These men were wealthy, used to, in their own past, having coloured help around them. They were probably raised themselves by coloured. The only different person is one of the young white wives would have probably been called white trash in her own place. But she's been brought in by a man who actually fell in love with her, and she just finds it terribly difficult to cope with the situation there. And the segregation thing, the main theme is the toilets. It's sickening in a way, but there's some great humour there. And you can feel the horror and the pain of these women that they're forced into this situation. And the way the white women talk about them as if they're non-existent, even when they're in the rooms. It's a fascinating, and it is his history. It's a fascinating history. It seems modern, but actually it still goes on.
Of course it does, but it's mercifully, vastly different nowadays, certainly in America. But there was, you know, aftershocks from all this, and it's going to take a long time for it peters out altogether. But it's character-driven, but there's a damn good plot there
as
well.
It's lovely. It's a really well done.
You just root for them completely.
Yes, you really want these women to succeed, and you really want their book to succeed. Great read.
Absolutely. Now, next month, we're going to be looking at a very different book. So we're going to be doing a classic. This is Elizabeth Gaskell, who was a great writer of the 19th century. She wrote a number of books that are very fashionable at the present time, and we're going to look at one, North and South. So if you want to read along with us, listen to the recording, North and South by Elizabeth Gaskell. We'll be talking about that next month.
Mary and Stephen have just discussed the book The Help by Catherine Stockett. This book is available in hardcover, paperback, and downloadable audiobook. Here is Roland Burroughs with another extract from his memoir. This is from the chapter Guns.
It was whilst directing a TV commercial that I found myself looking down the wrong end of a barrel. I had secured the budget to hire a helicopter. The client wanted me to include some installations at Land's End because it was evidence of how well his double glazing withstood all the elements, and everything that full Atlantic winter gales had to offer. We had this idea of coming in from the ocean, zooming straight at the cliffs and then popping straight up over the craggy cliff edge to reveal the hotel in all its glory, windows facing us. As we zoomed in and spun around, on the screen it was obvious where the fiercest gales would be coming from. For a different aspect of the window's qualities, the soundproofing had to be demonstrated. This would be evident where aircraft took off and landed, so where better than an installation at the nearby naval base in Cornwall, where the company had recently replaced windows for the staff sleeping quarters. I had applied for permission to fly over the base and grab some location footage to establish context. This had been flatly refused. Luckily, I'd already shot some general footage of the base's surrounding countryside, but needed to show the military aspect of the base to give it authenticity. So when we landed, I drove with the crew to the airbase, and we simply stopped on the public road running alongside the perimeter fence. If something seems too easy, it often is. We parked at the side of the road, unpacked all the camera gear, set up and started filming. From our vantage point, we grabbed great shots of a concrete runway, a fenced Ministry of Defence area, and barbed razor wire revealing double glazed windows beyond. I thought I'd been clever in not identifying actual location or specific naval hardware or aircraft. Smugness gave way to fear as three Navy vehicles with blacked out windows screeched to a halt surrounding us. Eight men in full kit and pointing automatic guns grabbed us and threw us against the fence, our faces pushed into the wire. "Who's in charge?" "That's me," I answered, squirming to turn towards the voice. "Show me some ID." I got out my driving license, which was immediately grabbed out of my hand. It was then that I noticed the three guns pointed directly at me. "Mr. Burroughs," he smiled. "Would that be the same Mr. Burroughs who was recently refused permission to fly over the base?" Yes, that was me. The crew here knew nothing about it." "And so you decided what exactly?" "Well, this is a public road. Anyone can drive past the base. Anyone can walk past or even park here," I said, confidently thinking I knew my rights. "But not everybody can if they've been categorically refused permission. Nor can they if we suspect from our CCTV footage that this camera of yours is looking remarkably like a mobile bazooka." Then he screamed in my face. "Nor can they if they're marched off to our cells and held on suspected terrorism charges." He had a point. He called his men off. They began to depart, and he stood back two paces before barking at us to "F off out of it and go off." As it was, luckily, they'd confiscated no footage. We kept all of our dramatic Land's End aerial cliff scenes and still had shots of airbase windows seen through Ministry of Defence barbed wire, all of which, thankfully, featured fully in my ITV commercial. That whole episode got me thinking back to when I first became truly aware of guns, in France, during the summer of 1962. I was just 14. I'd been on a school trip to Annecy in the French Alps, and for the return journey we'd been given a 3-day, 2-night stopover in Paris. We stayed at a private boarding school in the city. None of us really spoke French, so our first day was mostly spent wandering the corridors of this vast residential school, being amused by doors with many weird names and instructions, and by the open-plan unisex toilets. It seemed that the French weren't constrained by gender prejudice. Even in the early 60s, we were amused as well as being somewhat shocked, in our very British, prudish way, by girls walking through whilst we stood there going. And it didn't take long to become bored with what we called the laundry basket dash. This involved one of us climbing into a large wicker basket, which was padded out with spare dormitory pillows, all around and over the head and face. Once inside, you'd wait, losing all bravery as the lid was lowered. You heard the basket creak as classmates grabbed each side and then left, and felt the rush as their pushing began to be slung at speed down the corridor until smashing into the wall at the far end of the gallery. Laughing and crying with mixed courage, fear and relief, we lined up and took turns to do it all over again. We stopped when a suspected broken finger was confirmed. Who'd have expected him to stick his hand out of the basket? On our second day, which must have been August 22nd, myself and two friends had excused ourselves from an organised trip and decided to wander around the immediate area. Becoming lost, we were strolling along some unknown side street when two vehicles screeched around the corner. Men jumped out carrying rifles, and there was much pointing and excitable shouting. One man lifted a manhole cover and squatted halfway down, pointing his gun back to the corner. More men came from other cars and ran back down to the main road carrying more guns, their boots click-clicketing across the cobbles. Someone then spotted us and screamed for us to run. Allez! Vous allez! We did. As fast as our little legs could manage, we were laughing in that weird way you do when frightened. It was too exciting, and we might have slowed down, but seconds later we heard gunfire, and we knew not to look back. It was some time afterwards, returning home to the UK, that we learned of the assassination attempt. To this day, we cannot truly know, but events seem to suggest that it was the assassins themselves who chased us away. All I know for certain is, on that day in Paris, 1962, France's president, Charles de Gaulle, and his wife Yvonne were very, very lucky to survive the machine gun and rifle attack on their Citroën car. And we were lucky too, for not really understanding what was happening, but it'd run like hell anyway.
Extracts from further chapters of Roland's memoir will appear in future programmes. Viv Wilson is here with her segment One Foot in the Past. This month, Viv shares the story of Maurice Mortimer of Teignmouth.
It is November 2019, just 4 months before the COVID made its unwelcome appearance in the world. In Teignmouth Triangle, people gather to mark the 11th hour of the 11th day, the 11th month. Meanwhile, up on the hillside cemetery, a woman tenderly lays a poppy wreath on a war grave where her father was laid to rest. She makes a long journey down from the Isle of Man to do this whenever she can, and when it's not possible, she allows me the privilege of carrying out this act of remembrance for Maurice Louis Mortimer, born Teignmouth, 1916. He grew up in Sunny Crest, on the hill opposite Bitton House. His father's business, the West End Garage, was next door, and Morris worked in it. He was also a part-time fireman with the local brigade, which was based at that point and during the Second World War in the town hall in Brunswick Street, Tynmouth. The town had been hit very hard by air raids, more so than any other town of a similar size. On the 13th of August 1942, 8 enemy planes flew in low at 150 feet, creating the 17th air raid, as each one dropped a high explosive bomb. It was 5:30 in the afternoon, and Morris was the only fireman on duty, and he was mortally wounded. Tynmouth Hospital had been bombed, or virtually destroyed completely the year before, so 26-year-old Morris was taken to the makeshift hospital in Hermosa House on Lanscore Road. His young wife, Marion, married only 18 months before, was advised to stay home with her 9-month-old daughter, Vivian, and not attempt to visit. Morris passed the following day. I became aware of this tragic story a quarter of a century ago while compiling 3 books about Tynmouth during the Second War. Morris's daughter and I share the same Christian name, and we keep in touch. And when Tynmouth's new fire station opened in 2006, Vivian was invited to attend the official opening, but circumstances prevented her attendance. Eventually, she and Mark, one of her 3 sons, were able to have a full tour, and which she met the former chief officer, Tom Radford, who had actually known Morris, her father. His photograph is now displayed in the station, and also in Bitten House, beside the bronze bell from the fire engine damaged during the air raid. So let's remember Morris Louis Mortimer, and let's do a salute for all firefighters everywhere. God bless them.
It's over to Fran with the answers to the quiz questions.
Here I am again with the answers to this month's questions. Did you get most of them right? Well, let's see how you actually did. Question 1. Which man-made Egyptian waterway connects the Mediterranean Sea with the Red Sea? The answer was B. The Suez Canal. Question 2. Baobab, monkey puzzle, and banyan are all types of what? The answer was B. A tree. Question 3. What did Tom steal in the first line of the nursery rhyme, Tom? Tom the Piper's Son. It was a pig. Question 4. Where is the harbour wall known as the Cob, which featured in the novels Persuasion and The French Lieutenant's Woman? The answer was C. Lyme Regis. Question 5. Which ITV series starred Felicity Kendall and Pam Ferris as a pair of gardening detectives? The answer was A. Rosemary and Thyme. Question 6. In a famous book by Anna Sewell, what kind of creature is Black Beauty? The answer was C, a horse. Question 7. Red, fallow, and roe are all varieties of which British mammal? The answer was A, deer. Question 8. In which year was the London Eye constructed? The answer was A, 2000. Question 9. Santiago is the capital of which South American country? The answer is A, Chile. And question 10. What is the surname of TV wine taster Jilly, known for her creative descriptions of different wines? The answer is C, Goulden. Well, how did you cope? Were the answers what you expected, or did I manage to mislead you? Hope you enjoyed the quiz and managed to learn something new. I'll go away and find another batch of questions for next month. Bye!
David Quay is here to talk about his love of the music and lyrics of Gilbert and Sullivan.
Hello, I'm David from the Red Team, and I've decided to entitle my contribution to this month's Roundabout as My Great Passion in Life. It may well indeed surprise you to learn what it is. Well, it's something to do with a partnership, things or people that go together. Well, you know what I mean. Things like fish and chips, eggs and bacon, salt and pepper, Morecambe and Wise, Jekyll and Hyde, and so on. Well, my passion is Gilbert and Sullivan. Yes, the complete and perfect fusion of the captivating music of Arthur Seymour Sullivan and the memorable lyrics of William Schwenk Gilbert. You've probably heard it said that, like Marmite, you either love the product or hate it. Well, I actually dislike Marmite intensely. But with Gilbert and Sullivan, oh well, that's a love affair that has endured since childhood. Their partnership first saw the light of day shortly after Dickens' death and during the middle of Queen Victoria's long reign. This musical collaboration began in early 1875 when theatre manager and well-known impresario of the day, Richard Dawley Card, brought Gilbert and Sullivan together. He yearned to replace the bawdy burlesques of badly translated French operettas that were at the time dominating the London stage. And so, almost immediately after their initial meeting, Gilbert and Sullivan produced their first work, Thespis, a flop that has never been revived. And then a one-act offering set in a courtroom and focusing on a breach of promise of marriage entitled Trial by Jury. This was followed by the not too well-known Sorcerer, set incidentally in the West Country, before their first really big hit, to use the modern vernacular, HMS Pinafore in 1878. This work had phenomenal success and ran for 571 performances, indeed almost a record at the time. It introduced a popular saying of the day, taken from the words spoken between Captain Corcoran and Sir Joseph Porter, KCB, "What never? No, never. But never? Well, hardly ever." However, hundreds of pirated productions of Pinafore opened in America, and so, in order to secure copyright for their next opera, The Pirates of Penzance, The latter was first performed in New York with a simultaneous performance at the Bijou Theatre in Paignton, now known as the Palace Theatre, in order to secure British rights. And so the stage was set for a success story which spiralled to unfathomable heights. But why do I enjoy Gilbert and Sullivan so much, apart from the words and music? Most of all, I think, I enjoy the many diverse characters in the canon. It's rather akin to those created slightly earlier by Charles Dickens. Mr. Pecksmith, Mrs. Gamp, Thomas Gradgrind, and Mr. Fizzywig, and so on. In Gilbert and Sullivan, we meet a number of characters who are seemingly totally unsuited to the responsibilities they bear. A learned judge who is not learned at all. A First Lord of the Admiralty who's never been to sea. A Major General who knows something about everything except army tactics. A cheap tailor promoted to the position of Lord High Executioner in the Mikado, who admits he couldn't even kill a bluebottle. And a Lord Chancellor in Iolanthe, who sees no definable distinction between his upholding the law, despite his admitting that he does so, and his own love interest. Furthermore, there is a plethora of other significant characters, some more well-known than others. Two poets, one fleshly and one idyllic, namely Reginald Bunthorne and Archibald Grosvenor from Patience. Ladies Blanche and Psyche, who run a ladies' university in Princess Ida. A certain wicked baronet, Sir Despard Murgatroyd in Ruddigore. A broken-hearted jester, Jack Point in Yeoman of the Guard, and the Duke of Plathatoro, an impoverished grandee of Spain in the Gondoliers, and many, many more. Well, so much for this month, but I'll be back in April, talking about other aspects of my passion for Gilbert and Sullivan, and about the Savoy Theatre, where the first opera to be performed there with the advent of electricity was Iolanthe. And of course, I'll also be mentioning those tongue-twisting patter songs and my own top three from the entire canon. However, for now, the song and artist that first took me to Gilbert and Sullivan in my salad days. John Reed, the late principal comedian of the original Doyley Cart Opera Company as Sir Joseph Porter, KCB, singing his introductory song, "When I Was a Lad, I Served a Term as Office Boy to an Attorney's Firm," from HMS Pinafore.
Examination at the Institute. Said pass examination did so well for me that now I am the ruler of the Queen's Navy.
Has cross examination did so well for me that now he is the ruler of the Queen's Navy.
Of legal knowledge I acquired such a grip that they took me into the partnership, and that junior partnership, I ween, was the only ship that I ever had seen.
The only ship we ever had seen.
But that kind of ship so suited me that I am the ruler of the Queen's Navy.
But that kind of ship so suited me that now he's the ruler of the Queen's Navy.
I grew so rich that I was sent by a pocket borough into Parliament. I always voted at my party's core, and I never thought of thinking for myself at all. I thought so little, they rewarded me by making me the ruler of the Queen's Navy.
Thought so little, they rewarded me by making me the ruler of the Queen's Navy.
Now, landsmen all, whoever you may be, if you want to rise to the top of the tree, if your soul isn't fettered to an office stool, be careful to be guided by this golden rule.
Be careful to be guided by this golden rule.
Stick close to your desks and never go to sea, and you all may be rulers of the Queen's Navy.
Stick close to your desks and never go to sea, and you all may be rulers of the Queen's Navy.
Our thanks go to John Townsend and his guest, David Force, Fran Frank, David Picton, Norma Orty, Mary MacDonald, Stephen Taylor, Roland Burrows, Viv Wilson, and David Quay. Thanks also to Jenny Horton for helping me with the copy and dispatch, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor, and edited by Stephen Taylor and Mike Smith.